the book of Esther. Keep it open because I shall be referring to it again and again. And once again, let me say this, that those of you who want the notes for this study, well, they are already on my website. And if you happen to have a smartphone with you and with a data plan, you can always access the notes there. Now, some of you may be wondering how to use these notes on the website. Now, what you do is, first, you download the PowerPoint file. And when you see the PowerPoint file, you open it, you see the first slide. You also download the MP3 file. And as you listen to the MP3 file being played out, then you look at the PowerPoint. It is not synchronized. I'm not that clever to synchronize the slides with the audio. So you will have to listen. And as you listen, you know, and as you watch the slides, you will know which one is being referred to, and you just switch it on. So that's how you will benefit from the downloading of these files. As to the notes, well, they are just for your reference. The two important files are the PowerPoint files and your audio files. Of course, they are not there now because I'm speaking now. You will be able to retrieve them tomorrow when I put them up today. Right. We have now come to the last study of our extra notes on Ezra, Nehemiah, and today we shall be doing Esther. This is the third book that we are studying, and I think you'll be very fascinated by it. The only thing I am a bit disappointed is perhaps I may not have enough time to cover. But at the same time, I know that there is no Sunday school today. So I may take advantage of it. Right. Esther is a tremendous book. If you are an addict to the television series on Korean movies and Japanese movies, you would appreciate Esther. Because Esther has the same theme and structure as the movies in Korea and Chinese. Same structure. The customs, the concubines, the kings, the princes, the intrigues in the palace and so on. Everything the same. And not only that, you'll find that the book of Esther will have a strong impact and implication to us who are living in Malaysia today. What is going on? That is a pointer that all of us, or all of you, should read Esther. Alright, very quickly, I must go through the first part. Again, we shall be discussing the person of the book, the perspective of the book, and the peculiarities in the book. Before I go on to the real study itself, I'd like to go back last week when I mentioned to you about the shut gate at the east wall. When I mentioned to you Ezekiel chapter 44 verses 1 to 3, I want to clarify the text there. It says there, "Then he brought me back to the outer gate of the sanctuary, which faces toward the east." That would be the Lord bringing Ezekiel back to see the situation in the temple. But it was shut. "And the Lord said to me, this gate shall be shut, it shall not be opened, and no man shall enter by it, because the Lord God of Israel has entered by it, therefore it shall be shut. As for the prince, because he is the prince, he may sit in it to eat bread before the Lord. He shall enter by way of the vestibule of the gateway and go out the same way." Now, last week I mentioned to you that this gate could be the gate in the eastern wall in Jerusalem, which the Jews believed to be only able to be opened when the Messiah comes. Now, according to verse 3, it's the prince who will open it and shall enter by the dead way. Now, who is the prince? The Jews would believe that it would be the Messiah. But if you look at the context, especially when you compare that with Ezekiel chapter 43, verses 1 to 3, you'll find that it's not the Messiah. It's not the Lord Jesus Christ. And some believe that it could be a resurrected King David who would open that door, or who would enter by that gate. Others would believe that it would be the administrator of the temple. Now, there are a lot of controversies about that, about this verse, about who the prince actually is. I, to be frank, I'm not sure, and I will just leave at that. Alright, this is the gate referred to. One I did not show you, or did not bring your attention to it, was in front of the gate was a cemetery. A Muslim cemetery. Now, this is important. The Muslims believed also that the Messiah might come through the gate. And what they did in putting a cemetery there in front of the gate was that, well, they believed that a holy man would not go past through dead bodies. So if the Messiah was a holy man, he would not go through the dead bodies of the Muslim cemetery to open the gate. And the gate will never be opened, as the Jews would believe to be opened. And so that's how the Muslim cemetery was there, and is there now still. Those who went to Israel would see that cemetery, that Muslim cemetery in front of the gate. Alright, now many people believe that it would be Messiah because the Lord Jesus Christ himself, Matthew 24 verses 1 to 3, when he was on the Mount of Olives, he looked down and saw in the Kidron Valley the Dome of the Rock, where the temple was. Of course, today you do not see the temple. You see the mosque, the Dome of the Rock. Underneath, of course, would be, as it would be claimed, the temple. And so many believers believe, many Jews believe, that one day the mosque would be demolished so that they would able build a third temple. So that there are rumors around, and more than rumors, some established facts too, that these Jews are collecting these stones for the building of the temple to come. Well, that will be in Ezekiel, the third temple to be built. And so that's the mosque with its beauty, where one day people believe that this mosque will be destroyed, and that will lead on to the Third World War or Armageddon, because with the destruction of that mosque, then there will be tremendous disaster. Okay, that's just by the way. So I want to clarify this, that the shut gate at the wall may not be the gate referred to in Ezekiel chapter 44, because that would be the gate at the temple court. Right. Now, a very quick recapitulation of what we had studied with regard to Ezra notes on Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. You remember that there was this first return from Persia, who had already conquered Babylon, to Jerusalem under Zerubbabel, when Cyrus gave the decree for them to return. But that was to reconstruct the temple. Remember that Zerubbabel went back to reconstruct the temple, but there were enemies around, and the work of constructing the temple was suspended for nearly 20 years. Then, later on, when Darius became king, he found that letter, that decree of Cyrus, and he allowed the temple to be built. So it took nearly 20 years for the temple to be rebuilt. Then there came the second return under Ezra. Ezra came, under Ezra. he came about 50 years later to bring about reforms, because the people who had returned to Jerusalem had lapsed into their complacent life again. Therefore, there was the return to Jerusalem. There was a return, and they were led, and Ezra was sent to bring about reforms. Then there was the third return, about 12 years later, under Nehemiah. And that was to build the wall. So you must distinguish between the various returns. Alright? So let me repeat. First, there was the return under Zerubbabel to build the temple. Then there was a return under Ezra to bring about reforms. Then there was the return under Nehemiah to build the wall. Now, Esther. Where does Esther come in? Esther comes in between Ezra chapter 1 to 6 and 7 to the rest of the book. Esther would come in during this time, during this gap. So what we are studying now is not Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, but rather back to Esther in between chapters 1 to 6 of Ezra and 7 and 10. Right. With this, the book of Esther. What can we study about the book of Esther? Very quickly, chapters 1 and 2, we have Esther becoming queen because Vashti was dethroned. 3 and 4, we find the plan to exterminate the race of the Jews. And then from chapters 5 to 7, we find Haman, who was the culprit to exterminate the Jews, being destroyed. And finally, we have the Jews coming back in force, chapters 8 to 10. All right? And of course, all these important sections were marked by feasts. Feasts play a very important part in the study of Esther. Let's go on. The person of the book, very quickly. Esther was a Persian name. It was not a Jewish name. It was a Gentile name, perhaps given by the king when she joined the harem of concubines. Now, those of you well addicted to Korean movies, Chinese movies, would know the king would always have a harem of concubines. So Esther was recruited to be one of the concubines when Vashti was dethroned. Actually, that name Esther would be from Ishtar, the name of the Babylonian goddess that God forbid that Jews should worship, but it was a name given by the king. Well, there was a movie about Esther, and she looked beautiful. I'm not sure whether the original Esther looked as beautiful as she looked like. Her Jewish name was Hadassah, which means myrtle, a flower, a very beautiful flower. And her Greek name actually means a star, Esther. And so you find this name Esther is actually a Gentile name and not a Jewish name. Right, that's a Persian name. What about her background? She was a daughter of Abihail, a Benjamite, and uncle of Mordecai. Now, those of you who are good in relationships would quickly come to the conclusion, therefore, Esther and Mordecai would be cousins. Because Esther's father would be the brother of Mordecai's father. Therefore, they would be cousins. So, in actual fact, they were cousins, but the parents of Esther died. And therefore, she was adopted by Mordecai, and she became her daughter. So, from cousin became daughter. Let me give you a real and practical illustration. Some of you might know Mr. Tan Wah Kim. His wife is Mrs. Tan Wah Kim or Dorothy Tan. Dorothy Ang. her, when I was small, I was brought up by my grandparents. They were superstitious, and as superstitious pagan parents, if a child was sickly, then you would give the child away for adoption. And I was given away for adoption. I and Dorothy Ang were cousins because her mother, her father was my father's brother. I hope you get the connection. So we were cousins. But then I was given as to be adopted by the mother. So Dorothy Ang became my cousin, my sister. And I called her sister. And do not be mistaken again, do get confused, because Dorothy Ang is my daughter. So Dorothy Ang is both my sister and my daughter, my real daughter. Because when she was born, I wanted her to be like her auntie, Dorothy Ang. She was a good pianist, and I hope that she would become a good pianist also. She gave up after some time. Alright, then her ancestor was, if you look through chapter 2 verses 5 and 6, was Kish among them. And but you must not be mistaken, Kish again. Kish was the father of Saul. Don't mistake that this Kish was that same father, because this Kish was, I think, the fourth generation above Esther. So Saul lived longer than that. So don't get it confused. Her family did not avail themselves of the decree granted by Cyrus to go back to Jerusalem, and so they decided to stay back in Persia and with Mordecai. So that's the background. Now, what about her present position now? Ahasuerus, King Ahasuerus, was very furious when his queen refused to turn up for a dinner. And due to a very complicated process, she was dethroned, and Esther was enthroned. You can read about it in chapter 1, 13 to 18. So that one I shall leave to the speakers to deal with them, with this part of the story when they deal with the chapters. Her character. She was a woman of deep piety and patriotism. I'll illustrate them as I go on afterwards. She was a willing, docile, and dutiful daughter to her adopted father, and dedicated to his counsels for the good of the Jewish people. For example, in chapter 2, verse 20, Mordecai advised her, "Don't ever reveal your nationality to the king. You are a Jew. Do not tell him that you are a Jew, because some of the Persians are very prejudiced against Jews. So keep that as a secret." And she did so. She was a good wife, apparently, to the king, because she was told that anything you would petition or you would ask, I will give you. So she had a very good relationship with the king, and she knew how to make use of that relationship later on to the advantage of her community. She was a winsome personality in chapter 2 verse 15, so that the people around said that she looked beautiful and she grew in favor with them. Her contribution to preserving her community, that is described for us in chapter 7. I shall discuss chapter 7 in great detail after this. Now, the perspective of the book. First of all, Esther's authorship is unknown, anonymous. We are not sure who wrote Esther. Some Bible scholars believe that it could be Mordecai, Ezra, or Nehemiah. But apparently it was someone who knew the Jewish customs well and the culture to be able to illustrate and to give the background of certain events that took place. What about divine authorship? This is one book, where you cannot find even the word God mentioned. The word God is not mentioned at all in the book of Esther. Perhaps I'll give a special prize for anyone who can find that name God. Or for that, all that matters, Almighty or any associate name with God in the book of Esther. Not there. Does it mean, therefore, that this book is not inspired by God? Does it mean, therefore, that God is not behind the book of Esther? Well, purely, this book is historical. And when it's historical, it means the facts described can all be reinforced from history. That everything was accurate. The kings that came into existence, the events that took place, all could be verified from history. So it was a true book, authentic book. And yet, not only God is not mentioned in the scripture, in Esther, there is no reference to it in the New Testament. This is again one book where the New Testament does not refer to it. No reference to Esther in the New Testament. So it gives the impression that this book is not inspired. This book should not be in the Bible at all. But strange, although God is not mentioned, as we have found in Ezra and in Nehemiah, you could trace the finger of God behind. You could trace the hand of God behind everything that happened. And that would be my purpose in discussing with you chapter 7 in detail afterwards. To show you how God was behind everything, although God was not known. And God did not reveal himself as he was. Very quickly, just a reminder. You remember the hand of God in Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther? The hand of God in Ezra, chapter 7, verse 6, chapter 7, verse 9, chapter 7, verse 28, chapter 8, verse 18, chapter 8, 22, 31. Already discussed the hand of God in Nehemiah and in Ezra's book. We also saw the hand of God in Nehemiah. For example, Nehemiah chapter 2 verse 8, Nehemiah 2:18. So the hand of God was in Ezra. The hand of God was in Nehemiah. Was the hand of God in Esther? You can see clearly, but not mentioned, the unseen hand of God in Esther from chapters 4 to 6 and chapter 8, 9 to verse 17. The hand of God very clearly, not mentioned specifically, but definitely you could sense that God was behind all these events that took place. Especially chapter 7, which then would give rise to the question, because of the things that happened in chapter 7, could all these things be coincidence? Could all these things be a chance? Or would it be the hand of God moving events that happen, putting people in the right places and at the right time so that things that happen were for the glory of God? Alright? So that is a question that we will be discussing in chapter 7. When was this book written? It was written about 465 BC, or perhaps later, when the son of King Ahasuerus, that would be King Artaxerxes, reigned. We are not sure, but it would be something about that time. To whom written? It was written to Jews everywhere to encourage them, because the Jews in the book of Esther were threatened. And they were to be eliminated from the world, from the earth. But somehow the hand of God preserved them. So it was written to the Jews everywhere and even up to today to encourage the Jews. Today the Jews are being persecuted all over the world. And the book of Esther is being read every time, every year, to encourage them to see that God God still will preserve them, although they have been persecuted by all, by most countries in the world today. The Jews in the book of Esther were facing a life and death situation, but God's sovereign hand moved to deliver them. The message of hope and the power of God is needed by so many today. The great book of Esther gives hope to all who are in desperate circumstances, wondering if God can help them. Not only is this a book of hope for the Jews, it is a book of hope for all those Christians even who have been persecuted in the world, communities who have been thrashed, who have been stepped upon by the people of the world. The book of Esther is a book of encouragement. Right, why was it written? One, to preserve the history of the Jews. The rise of Esther to power in the Persian kingdom. How Esther came up as a Jewish girl and became the queen of Persia to be able to display so much power to preserve her community. The reign of King Ahasuerus of Persia is all history. The ruthless plot to exterminate the Jews. It is not only a few Jews, but to exterminate the whole race of the Jews. And this we see was not successful, but a repeat was seen in the time of Hitler, when he also had this purpose of eliminating the whole race of the Jews. So today, if you ask me, can you tell me in one word that God is real, the Bible is real, and all these are true? And I can just say to you, the Jew. It is a wonder today that all the civilizations that existed in the time past, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Medes, they are all gone. But the Jew is still here. And the Jew does not seem to be able to be eliminated. The Jew still controls the economy of the world. Today, the Jew is the word to prove the inspiration of scriptures and that God is real. And nobody indeed can destroy the Jew, no matter what happens. The rescue of the Jews by the sovereign hand of God, as we have seen in the past, today even, and also we shall see how God will rescue the Jews when all the nations of the world are gathered together in the battle of Armageddon to destroy the nation of Israel, and yet Israel will come forth victorious. Here we see also Mordecai's rise to prominence, how he was deceived into arrogance because he thought he was very powerful, and of course led him to his destruction. And today we see in our country too, of how leaders, they seem to be very arrogant, they seem to think that nobody can touch them, and then they will rise up to as high as they can to positions that will give them a lot of influence. But we know that one day God is in control and God will take action. And so we find those enemies and adversaries being destroyed by God to preserve the Jews. And finally, we have the rejoicing in the institution of the Feast of Purim. Now, what is this Feast of Purim? We shall find out afterwards. Let's carry on with the historical purpose of writing this book. It's a reminder to the returned Jewish exiles that God is faithful. He will protect his true followers in any situation. God had sent the Jews out into Babylon because they refused to give the land a rest, because they were disobedient to God. God sent them out, and God said, after 70 years I will bring you back. And God had brought them back, and God had been faithful to all his promises and everything according to his time, not 1 year earlier, not 1 year later. And so today, as we see the current affairs around us, we may be wondering, why is not God acting? God is acting, but he acts according to his time. So we need to wait for him to work. The revelation of the sovereignty of God his powerful hand intervening in circumstances for the good of those who fear him. So what is important is that we need to fear him. The rule of God will judge every person according to his works. That again we shall see as we go on. Right. Now the peculiarities in the book. The peculiarity. As with the Korean movies and the Chinese movies, you will notice that in every movie where the kings are gathered together, there must be feasts. There must be drinking, there must be wine served, and they must drink. And somehow, that was a custom. This is a custom too, in the book of Esther. It's interesting. Thrice, the 10 banquets in the book of Esther. 10! First one, the king's banquet for his princes to begin the 180-day display of the riches of the glorious kingdom. Chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, first occurrence. The king had a big feast, and that feast lasted 180 days. 3 months. Look at chapter 1, verses 3 and 4. 3 months. And it's all for his princes and the nobles in his palace. And he brought up all his gold, his jewelry, his ornaments to show off how rich and how prosperous. But of course, you would know that many of these things were taken and stolen from the temple when Babylon attacked the temple. And all those gold furniture were taken out from the temple into Babylon. And now, the king of Persia said it's all his. The king's 7-day banquet for the people of Shushan, from great to small. Chapter 1, verses 3 to 4, the king held 180 days of feasting. Immediately after that, he held another banquet for the people of his country. 7-day banquet. Tremendous. How would you like to just go feasting and feasting and feasting for all these days? 7 plus 180, 187 days, 6 months more. Now, that's where the trouble came. The queen refused to obey. You see, the whole idea of chapter 1, 5, verses 5 to 8, of the king holding the 7-day banquet, was to take his queen to show off to the people. How beautiful my queen is. How great my queen is. And to put on her the crown and to be paraded in front of everybody. The queen refused to be treated in this way. So, well, you know, anybody else, anybody who refuses to obey the king will be in trouble. And so the king was in trouble. And the king asked the counselors what they should do. Just like the Korean movies also. A lot of counselors. What should we do? And there will be a meeting of all the counselors, and they would be sitting down, you know, row after row. And then what should we do? Oh, we must punish the queen. We must punish the queen. If we do not punish the queen, soon news will get around to all the husbands. The wives can disobey the husbands, and then the husbands will have no face anymore. Destroy the queen. Get rid of the queen. And so the queen was dethroned. A new queen was to be enthroned. And that's where Esther came in. And it took nearly one whole year to prepare all the concubines, one by one, to come forward to face the king. Who would be the one to be chosen to be the queen? Nearly one year. And so that's how Esther became queen. So she refused to come before the king wearing the royal crown, and she was put aside. The banquet was given. Then another one was given to celebrate Esther's coronation. Chapter 2, verse 18. Esther became queen. Then there was another. When Esther became queen, Haman wanted to destroy the Jews. He hated Mordecai. And he wanted to destroy Mordecai, and he knew Mordecai was a Jew, and he wanted to destroy all the Jews in the land. And so he had a banquet. That's the best way to plan to conspire to bring about any intrigue, you just have a feast. So when you are invited to a feast, be careful who the host is, whether that person has ulterior motive or not. So the king was invited by Haman to a feast, and the whole idea was to make the king come up with a decree to exterminate all the Jews in the land. Chapter 3, verses 8 to 15. Fifthly, there was another banquet. Queen Esther heard about it because Mordecai heard about it, and he said, do you know that Haman was planning to have to destroy and to get rid of all the Jews? So Esther was told about it, and Esther, well, he planned a feast. She planned a feast. And in that first feast, she invited the king and Haman. Only two people. I'd like you to read that, because that is a very interesting passage. Esther chapter 5, verses 5 to 8. Esther chapter 5. Then the king said, cause Haman to make haste that he may do as Esther had said. So the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther and the king said. And the king said unto Esther at the banquet of wine, what is thy petition, and it shall be granted thee? What is thy request? Even to the half of the kingdom it shall be performed. Then answered Esther, my petition and my request is, if I have found favor in the sight of the king, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and to perform my request, let the king and Haman come for the banquet. Now, this was asked again in verse 3, when the king also asked Esther, what wilt thou, Queen Esther, and what is thy request? It shall be given you. What is your request? What is your petition? What is your request? She was very clever. My petition is that you hear my request. My request is that you grant my request. Very clever. She did not reveal her ulterior motives. So, my request is that you and Haman come for a second dinner with me. So, a second dinner was planned. And again, Haman came along with the king. Haman thought, wow, the queen is so happy with him that he is invited second time. And he discussed with his wife and his family and said, oh, they are going, the king is going to promote you. You're going to make you a very important person. So they were very happy. Haman went. And at that second banquet, we find later on that the queen, pointed out to the king that he was the culprit who wanted to exterminate. That we leave it there. Seventh banquet, the public banquet of the Jews when the decree was given in Shushan. So, earlier, Haman succeeded in getting the king to come up with a decree to exterminate the Jews. So, the decree went out. Now, again, you must understand this. When the decree went out, it said that all Jews would be killed. And when later on, the queen told him about the plan of Haman, I told the king about the plan to exterminate Jews, the king was angry, and she requested the king to repeal the decree. You cannot repeal. Once a king's decree had been made, it cannot be repealed. Same as with Daniel. Remember Daniel? He was thrown into the lion's den because the king had made a decree. He must go to the lion's den. He cannot withdraw. And so the king said, sorry, I cannot destroy, I cannot withdraw. I have given out the order that all the Jews must be destroyed. So what to do now? Now here again, is this God's plan? Is that God behind? Would the Jews be exterminated? So that was a public banquet of the Jews when the decree was given in Susan, the capital, to elevate Mordecai to the rank of second only. Now, what happened was this. The queen later on told the king that Mordecai had saved his life because two men had planned to kill him, and then it was chronicled in the archives. They took out the chronicles, they read the history, it was true. Then the king realized that he had made a mistake. So what could he do? A decree had been given out, exterminate the Jews. He gave out another decree. The Jews had a right now to fight back and kill all the Persians. And that's what they did. That's what they did. And therefore, they were successful in killing the enemies. And the Jews, after that, rejoiced. In two feasts, separate feasts, they rejoiced. Because they were successful in killing their enemies and their lives were preserved. And for that, to remember that day, the Feast of Purim was celebrated, and is still celebrated every year. For example, this year, February the 15th was the year when the Feast of Purim was celebrated. What is this Feast of Purim? Now, Purim actually comes from the word pure, and it means lot, lottery, lot. Chapter 3, verse 7. When Mordecai knew that he had the right to kill the Jews, he drew lots, which would be a good month to kill the Jews. So he drew the lot, the poor. And as he drew the lot, it came out that it was Adar, A-D-A-R, the 12th month of the calendar that he would kill the Jews. And so that would be, at that time was about 1 year, you know, because when he was drawing the lot, it was about first month, and this would be the last month. So he was happy. He was happy. There was 1 year to exterminate the Jews. And he was happy because Adar, he believed, was the month when Moses died. How good it was. The month that Moses died, the Jews would also die. But he forgot. According to Talmud, that Moses also was born on the same day he died. So you kill the Jews, they will live again. They will be reborn. Alright, so he forgot about that. Anyway, based on the conclusion of the scroll of Esther later on, which reads that they should make them days of feasting and gladness and of sending portions one to another and gifts to the poor. And that's how the Feast of Purim was kept and observed from that year onwards up to today. And today we have the celebration of the Feast of Purim. And what do you have? You have the donating to charity of to the poor, eating and celebrating and enjoying the feast, exchanging gifts of food and drink, and they gave out these triangular pastries filled with poppy seed. Why triangular? Some people believe that triangular because it refers to the years of Haman, the 2 years of Haman. Alright, then there was the recitation of of the scroll of Esther. It was read out. And then, in saying grace for their food, they added more. So, today, the Feast of Purim has been modernized. And as a result, there is drinking of wine, merrymaking, fun-making, and so on. So, the Feast of Purim today is observed in a very, very happy way. Alright. Finally, let me end with chapter 7. Was it coincidence or chance when you read through the book of Esther, especially with reference to Esther chapter 7, was it coincidence or chance of God's controlled circumstances that led Esther to do what she was, where she was? Or was it due to her own cunning connivance? Now, Esther chapter 4 verse 14, I'll show you the verse afterwards. Bear with me. Number one, was all this a coincidence? Look at the word so in chapter 7 verse 1. So. Chapter 7 begins with the conjunction so. Because of this, so that happened. What happened? Haman's plot to annihilate the Jews. Was it a coincidence? The people's predicament, their enemies were at the top. The people could not do anything. And yet, there was the provision of God to protect and to provide for his people. See what chapter 4 verse 14 has to say. For if thou, Mordecai told Esther, if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall there enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. If you refuse to open your mouth, and you allow Haman to destroy the Jews, note this. Okay, nothing will happen to you because you do not open your mouth. You will not be killed by the king. But I will use some other source to deliver the Jews. And as for you and your family, you'll be destroyed. God has his own purpose. If we refuse to do what he wants us to do, he has other means. He uses other means. But you will be robbed of that privilege to fulfill his will. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Do you realize that you are placed here today because of what the Lord has in plan for you and for the country and for the community? And you refuse to open your mouth. And perhaps you can refer this to today also, what is happening in this country. That we are placed in this country to be the Lord's mouthpiece as well. Alright. So, the countermeasures. Look at Esther's patience and petition. She was told, you must go to face the king. You must face the king. Now, again, those of you who are familiar with the stories, no queen or anybody could ever go to see the king without his permission. So it was the custom then. And when the person wanting to see the king appears, the king must give the person the op, O-R-B, the op. And if he touched the op, then the person will be allowed. And so the queen said, okay, if I perish, I perish. I'll go and see the queen, the king. Never mind. I'll perish, I perish. His her famous words in chapter 4, verse 16. And so she went. And at the gate, at the door, the king saw her. The king offered her the oblet, touched the oblet, and she was welcomed in. Was it a coincidence? Was it a chance? The 2 days of royal rejoicing at the banquet of wine. First, she gave to the king and Haman. Second day again, and then after that she made her move. The patient waiting to prepare for the plea. If I die, I die. If I perish, I perish. In the meanwhile, she told the people, 3 days, pray and fast for me. 3 days, pray and fast for me. So that I have the courage to go. And Haman's false impression with the second invitation that he was being welcomed, of course, turned out to be the other way around. Now, was it a coincidence? Was it a chance? When the king asked, what is your petition? She said, grant me my life. This is my petition. What is your request? Spare my people. This is my request. And the king, having made his word to the queen, must not withdraw. He must give her petition, her request. The reasonableness of the response. After all, Haman Haman in chapter 3 verse 9, verse 11, had offered the king, look, if you destroy the king and the Jews, I shall give you 2 million. I think chapter 3 verse 9. 20 million. I'll pay you 10,000 talents of silver. 10,000 talents of silver will be 20 million. At that time, 20 million, perhaps today's world, will be 2.6 billion. I'll give you the money. You do it. Get rid of the Jews for me. Get rid of these people for me. Get rid of these minorities for me. Those who are against the religion, get rid of them. 2.6 billion. So, Esther said, I and my people have been sold. I am prepared to be sold, to be slaves. But we are not being sold to be slaves. We are being sold to be exterminated. O king, grant my request. So, the king's reaction was quick. He demanded to know the person and the place where the person was. For one, because if he did not take action, then it would be too late. He believed in executing action immediately. So if anything was suspicious, action must be taken. You do not wait. Even if it was the prime minister who had done wrong, prime minister execution must be done immediately. No postponement. One day after 1 year, 1 year after 1 year. And Haman was the prime minister. And he was investigated. And he was investigated immediately. And sentenced, when found guilty, must be executed quickly. Ecclesiastes chapter 8, verse 11. And so, the king asked the queen, who is the person? Who is the person? Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. At the feast, Haman was now sandwiched in a tight spot. The word adversary means to put in a tight spot. So he was sandwiched. He could not get out. He could not get out. All the clues were getting at him. All the reports were coming in. All the fingers were pointing at him. He could not escape. He had to go. He was now singled out as the one who was sought after. Enemy is the word adversary. And so he was the enemy of the country, although he was the prime minister. He who sought to cause distress was now sadly distressed himself, so he was to be eliminated immediately. That was the execution of the Persian regime, in contrast to what we have today. He sent trouble. The prime minister sent trouble. He ran. Where? He ran to see Esther. The king himself was very furious. He went out to the garden, into the garden, and then Haman realized that he could not escape. He did not have a wife to go to, because the wife was at home enjoying herself, perhaps that the husband is now going to be promoted and so on. He ran to the queen. Please help me. But the king had decided, and so Haman was to be sentenced. When the king came back, he found Haman in a compromising position. There he was crouching down to the queen. Please help me. And of course, the first impression the king got was he was trying to beguile the queen. And that made him more angry. And he had nowhere to escape. And so the punishment was meted out. No waiting for any more explanation. How nice if it would be like this in our country. Even the wife cannot help him at all. No help. The man present at once carried out the execution. Alright? And the gallows that he prepared for Mordecai was used for him. And so, question, is this coincidence? Is this a chance? And so Esther chapter 7:10 ends with the word, so. So, they hang Haman on the gallows. Chapter 7 verse 1, so. Last verse, so. The result. Was it coincidence? Was it a chance? Or God was in controlling the circumstances? When Vashti was dethroned and Esther enthroned, when Esther credited Mordecai for saving the king from a conspiracy and having it chronicled, when Esther was confronted by Mordecai to come out and stand in company with the Jews, think not with thyself that thou shalt escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. When Esther's invitation was received by both the king and Haman repeatedly, when Haman misread Esther, listened to his wife and friends, and merrily went to the banquet, when the king could not sleep, sent for the chronicles and discovered that he owed a debt to the Mordecai, when Haman happened to be present to receive his recommendation to reward himself, when Haman's wife and advisors realized too late they could not resist God's people, were all these coincidences? Were all these chances? The point now is, God is behind it all. We know that all things work together for good, for them that love God, to them who are the called according to His purpose. God was behind it all, behind every circumstance and every coincidence. May the Lord bless us that as you read book of Esther, Ezra, Nehemiah in the coming days, may these books really be a great help to you in your life, each Christian life to come. The Lord bless.